Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. ThriveInFinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Tess Viglund. The economy is shedding jobs, so business magazines know they'll get a lot of interest by exposing the enormous salaries CEOs still get paid. This woman is sure interested.
In my line of work, we call that the swimsuit issue because it's very popular, very revealing.
That's Nell Minow of the Corporate Library with this week's Marketplace Money Inside quote. By how much has CEO pay risen in the last 10 years? Is it A, 2%, if you don't count perks like, you know, free mansions and stuff? Or is it more like B, 10%? Not hard to imagine when you hear the head of Goldman Sachs earned $70 million last year. Or is the answer C, CEO pay actually declined last year, albeit by only 0.2%. Make your guess, then stick around. The answer's on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Credit cards can help out with purchases big and small, but Lord help you if you miss even one payment. And have you ever tried to figure out your billing cycle or why you have to pay for overdraft protection you never asked for? Well, the finance police are finally charging in with some changes. I'm Tess Viglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
This week, the Federal Reserve joined other banking regulators in proposing new rules for the credit card industry. Card companies would not be allowed to change the interest rate on existing balances. They also could not continue something called double cycle billing. That's when interest is heaped not just on the current bill, but the prior one as well. And those expensive overdraft protections, you'd have the option of opting out. The proposals come as more and more members of Congress are urging a crackdown on the credit card industry. Congressman Barney Frank chairs the House Financial Services Committee. Welcome to the program, Congressman.
Thank you. I'm always glad to have a chance to talk seriously.
You have warned the Fed previously that in terms of its power to police credit card issuers, in your parlance, it should use it or lose it. Do you think it's doing enough at this point to cut down on abusive lending practices?
I'm very encouraged by what I've seen so far. First, the very fact that they acted. I said earlier this year when Chairman Bernanke testified before us on the economy that, having been on this committee for 28 years, his testimony was the first time I'd ever heard a chairman of the Federal Reserve say the words consumer protection. And the Federal Reserve was given the power to promulgate codes of conduct for financial institutions. And the code he has proposed that the Fed is adopted, and I haven't seen every detail, looks very much like the legislation you were talking about. We are not trying to tell the credit card companies what they can do prospectively, but they have developed a number of situations where you go out, you make purchases thinking that your interest rate is X, and then they retroactively increase the interest rate on purchases you've already made, on debt already incurred. That's a very unfair retroactivity. The Fed also acted another area we've been working on, which is overdraft protection, where they do you this favor of giving you this very expensive protection without fully telling you. But in the credit card area, they have done much of what we thought was important.
One of the Fed's proposals would make it tougher for card issuers to change the interest rates based on other things going on with a consumer's credit. It's often called universal default. The Fed proposal would allow that on new transactions, but not on what's already on your card. Does that go far enough for you?
Well, we essentially take the same position. Look, I believe in a free market. And if you have adequate notice and you're told, well, this is what it's going to be, then you can protect yourself. We have said that before they can raise your interest rate, they have to notify you and give you a certain period of time and you can say, okay, cancel the card. I'm not going to use it anymore. You know, but we should explain this universal default because it really just offends, I think, most basic principles of fairness.
Yeah, this is where you miss a payment on one card or, say, on your auto insurance or health insurance and all of your other cards jack up the rate.
Yes, and that's what we wanted to ban by legislation and the Fed has banned by regulation.
The banking industry has argued that if it's not allowed to make decisions based on an individual's risk profile, that could essentially mean eventually higher interest rates for everybody, and that banks will just start charging more in fees.
Well, in the first place, that assumes that they're voluntarily charging less than they can get away with now, which is nonsense. What are they, charities? So if they thought they could raise the rates and not lose business, they'd raise them now. Secondly, we're not saying based on that one person's risk profile, you can't raise the rates going forward. But there's no fairness in raising the rates on debt already incurred. That's all we're saying. And by the way, some of them say, well, you know what? If you don't let us do this, we might have to be a little tighter in allocating credits. You know, it's the same as when we put some law on the books. I hope we will. The House passed it to make it harder to get subprime mortgages in certain circumstances. And people said, well, we won't be able to give out as many mortgages. Well, good. They've given out mortgages and credit cards, frankly, too promiscuously.
Will you continue to press for legislation that goes beyond the Fed's proposed changes? And what would be the main elements so far that regulators have not dealt with?
Well, in the credit card area, I don't think there are a lot of those. I have to look more carefully at what they're doing in the overcharge issue. Right now, the entire burden of late payment, no matter what caused it, falls on the credit card holder. I think the argument for legislation is, yes, if we agree these are good things, let's make them permanent. Let's not leave them to the whim of a new Federal Reserve chairman.
Congressman Barney Frank chairs the House Financial Services Committee. Thank you so much for your time today.
I appreciate the chance.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
Ever had a fantasy about getting to decide how much the boss is paid? Turnabout is fair play, no? Well, on Monday, shareholders of the insurance company Aflac will, in a way, get to do just that. They'll get to vote on executive pay packages. Now, the vote isn't binding, but it is a first for a U.S. company. They already do it in other countries, including the U.K. So if it were to become the norm here, how exactly do you put a value on CEOs and other top executives? Ashley Milne-Tite found some answers.
10 years ago, CEO pay took up 5% of company earnings. Now it's 10%. Peter Wallison is with the American Enterprise Institute. He says shareholders aren't qualified to put a price on top executives, but boards of directors are.
They actually know what the CEO and the CFO are doing for a living. They know whether they are working well. They know whether they are producing value to a much greater degree than the shareholders would know.
But shareholder and corporate governance watcher James McRitchie says boards have paid too many CEOs far too much, and they've included some crazy perks at the expense of shareholders.
While you do have to pay to attract high-quality talent, you don't have to pay to fly their dog to get shampooed across the country.
It's not too difficult to find out whether companies you're invested in are excessively generous. Nell Minow of the Corporate Library says each year the Wall Street Journal, Business Week and Fortune publish issues on executive pay.
In my line of work, we call it the swimsuit issue because it's very popular, very revealing.
If you can bear it, it's worth digging through those proxy statements that stuff your mailbox every year. Richard Filato directs pension investment for the American Federation of State, County and Municipal Employees. He says proxy statements should contain information on executive pay.
If there isn't a clear explanation of how pay is linked to the performance of the company, you should be quite suspect.
And he says something else to consider.
If the company is losing money and the chief executive gets a guaranteed bonus, you know that's not performance-based pay.
Most Americans invest via mutual funds, of course. Nell Minow of the Corporate Library says investors can do their holdings good by letting mutual fund companies know they're paying attention to executive pay issues.
Call your mutual fund and say to them, how do you vote on these issues? I would like to know. Could you send me a copy of your voting policies on executive compensation issues?
The more pressure on those fund managers, Minow says, the more likely it is they will vote no on particularly hefty pay packages. Peter Wallison of the American Enterprise Institute says boards don't want to pay CEOs gazillions.
But frequently you cannot get the CEO that you think would be best for the shareholders unless you are able to offer what is essentially a market price.
And he says that price is often very high. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, we wanted to talk a little bit this week about a topic that we're getting a lot of email about these days, and it's something called peer-to-peer lending. Tell us what this is.
All right, it's called peer-to-peer lending, or some of the other terms that I like, Tess, social finance, or my favorite, off-the-grid finance. Now, here's the basic idea. You need a loan. You go to one of these peer-to-peer websites, or whatever you want to call it, and you find someone, an individual, not an institution, not a bank, but another individual, and they want to make you a loan.
And this is probably happening more and more because the banks themselves aren't doing a whole lot of loaning these days.
But here's the straight story. Peer-to-peer lending is a genuine financial innovation, but as the business grows, so will the risks. So you want to play? Hey, that's fine, but stay conservative, very conservative.
Now, why is that? If somebody wants to lend you money and they have a reason to trust that you're going to pay it back, why not go ahead and do this?
There's a couple of reasons. And by the way, I like these sites. It's positive. And if you want to diversify your portfolio a little bit, go ahead. That's a way of diversifying. But here are the two risks that I see. One is default risk. People default. And these are what we call unsecured loans. So it's really, if I make a loan to you.
I haven't put up any collateral.
Exactly. So that's a risk that's there. And I was reading this blog by a gentleman who did a fair amount of lending. And he didn't have a disastrous experience. But he said, you know what? People do default. And the line that really struck me is that he's now more empathetic to banks and credit card companies that charge higher rates.
Empathy for banks?
Exactly. So that's one risk. Here's the other risk. And this is a suspicion on my part. If you go to these websites, Tess, these are communities. It's appealing to people who want to help out somebody else, want to make a little money. But at the same time, they want to be part of a community. They don't like banks. They don't like these impersonal institutions. Mm-hmm. You know, they're really committed. They're going to pay off those loans and they're going to help other people. But as it becomes bigger and more websites grow and it becomes a business, you're going to attract less committed people. People are going to take advantage of the system. And frankly, I think you're going to end up with a default rate that reflects what happens to Citigroup.
Right. Let me ask you this very quickly. I've been starting to see some news stories that students are starting to look at these peer-to-peer websites for student loans, because as we've been reporting, the student loan market has tightened up quite a bit because of the credit crunch.
I don't think it is a good place to go to student loans. It's sort of down the list of places. But here's how I would approach it. If you're looking for a little bit of money, and we're talking, you know, $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, you know, why not see what you can get on one of these sites versus a private student loan?
Right.
But if you're talking about a fairly large sum of money, I don't think this is a good place because you have to make those regular payments. There's no forbearance. What if your economic circumstances change? Look at it. See if it may work for you. Sometimes people really do want to help people get an education, but recognize this is not a federal student loan, and it doesn't carry a lot of the benefits of those federal student loans.
All right. Chris Farrell with The Straight Story. We'll check back with you in a bit for some getting personal.
Thanks a lot.
The stimulus checks are coming. The stimulus checks are coming. But before you stash them away for a rainy day or start sizing up new flat screens, here's a more selfless option.
If they hear a plea, then maybe they would think, I can afford to give some or all of it away.
Rebate Charity, coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Many of you are feeling between $300 and $1,200 richer this week, or more if you have kids. Uncle Sam started direct deposits of economic stimulus money a week earlier than expected, and paper checks are about to go in the mail. Retailers are offering all kinds of sweeteners to help you spend that money. Our advice, of course, is to pay off your debt or add to your retirement account. Another option? Let someone else spend it. Danielle Carson reports.
The numbers aren't promising for nonprofits. Only 3% of those polled in a recent survey said they plan to give some or all of their rebate check to charity. Andrew Hastings of the National Philanthropic Trust says he understands why many households' bank accounts will get first dibs.
I think right now people are looking at the immediacy of their conditions that they're facing, you know, with gas prices high, the overall economic conditions, and I think they're going to be putting that towards their immediate family needs.
Because of that, many nonprofits won't be going after the rebate checks, but some are zeroing in on the one-time windfall. Take the Catalog for Philanthropy, which has set up an online program so nonprofits can tell their story and hopefully light a fire under would-be donors' good intentions. The Catalog's Kathy Jablonski.
We've created an e-tool for all of our charities that's customized to them that they can email out, encouraging people connected to their organizations to donate a portion of their rebate checks back to them.
One of those charities is the Manna Food Center in Rockville, Maryland. Volunteers are unloading dozens of crates of food at the center. It distributes 2 million pounds of donated food each year to families, homeless shelters, and soup kitchens. Amy Gabala, who runs the center, says the economic slump is hitting food banks hard, forcing many families to turn to charity for help.
I see people here who are coming for the first time. 500 families every week turn to Manna for food. The contributions we would receive through these tax rebate checks would help us feed the enormous number of people who are turning to Manna.
In the latest newsletter, Gabala asks people to donate some of their rebate check to Manna. Her pitch? The money would pay for trucks to collect food from grocery stores that would otherwise be tossed in the dumpster. She says $75 will feed 50 families. It's recess time at Rolling Hills Elementary School in Tacoma Park, Maryland. You'll find Robin Pollock here, volunteering her time as a playground monitor. She plans to give her entire rebate check to food banks and hopes other people will donate as well. But she suspects it hasn't occurred to them.
A lot of people's lives are extremely busy. But if they hear a plea, then maybe they would think, like, hey, you know, I can afford to give some or all of it away. Now that I've heard, yeah, I'll give that away.
Americans are a generous bunch. They gave nearly $300 billion to charity in 2006. Carol Bracewell hopes to tap into that generosity in her hometown, Madison, Wisconsin. She set up a website, forwardmadison.org, to encourage communities to pool their rebates for charitable causes.
The country is going into debt to give you this gift. Would you say to your son, yeah, you know, when I got that $500, I spent it on a plasma TV? Or would you say, when I got that $500, I put it in that playground the elementary school kids are going to play on?
Politicians want us to spend the rebate checks to boost consumer spending and help jumpstart the economy. Charities say while they're not in the business of turning a profit, they actually make up a hefty slice of the country's economic growth. Their operations account for 5% of the gross domestic product. That's more than $1 trillion. In Washington, I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace Money.
Here's something I've noticed in my daily commute. New condos are just everywhere. But if you're planning on owning a condominium anytime soon, you might be in for a big surprise. Mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac recently introduced new requirements for condo loans, and the changes may make the dream of owning real estate a lot tougher to fulfill. David LaRay is an economist with Recon Advisors. And David, what are these changes by Fannie and Freddie? Are they a good thing?
The changes were, at least in the beginning, good in terms of its direction and its purpose. If we're looking at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they're expecting lenders to do more due diligence on condo projects than they have ever done before. They expect lenders now to be looking at legal documents, association operating budgets, the percentage of unit owners that are late on their fee payments. All of this must be performed now by loan officers.
Who did this before? Would it be up to the borrower to check on all these sorts of things? Is basically the responsibility being shifted?
No one really claimed much responsibility for it. The lender did some of it. The borrower should have done some of it. But because of the misleading transactions that have taken place, particularly in the condo marketplace, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac are now getting more strict, placing a great deal more burden on the lender rather than the borrower.
So what's the practical effect then if you're looking to buy a condo? Is it simply going to be tougher because lenders don't want to bother with this sort of thing?
It will be tough. And I do think that lenders, a good number of them, just won't know what to do because it's very intimidating. Hundreds of pages of documents that these condos have. And now we are expecting a loan officer to go through those documents in a very careful manner. We may see that some of these deals just don't get done because the lender may not just want to go through so much trouble to get the transaction done.
So do these new rules then or requirements apply to loans where you're getting, say, a new condo? Or could this also affect you if you're trying to refinance?
It will affect refinancings as well, and this certainly could hurt the condo market.
Is there anything that a condo owner can do to make it more viable for a lender to go ahead and refinance with them?
I think it's really incumbent right now upon the condo owner to get their house in order, so to speak. They've got to be aware of the documentation now that is going to be necessary. This information will start to trickle down over time, and hopefully it'll just become commonplace and they'll know what to do. But right now we're in a transition period. It will harm rather than help the market in the beginning, but maybe in the end it will make this condo marketplace a healthier market for everyone.
David Loray is an economist with Recon Advisors. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com.
All right, it is time to get personal. It's our weekly look into the situations that affect your wallets and bank accounts. And with me again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
It's good to be back, Tess.
Excellent. Well, let's start off very quickly with clarifying a couple of elements from last week's show.
Oh, please, yes.
Okay, so first of all, we had the question about how to go about reducing your property taxes. And you mentioned a website, and I think we got a couple of the words wrong. So let's help folks out here. What is the actual website that can help them out?
Well, Tess, I misspoke. It's the American Homeowners Association, and I apologize for that. There's another thing that I'm upset at myself that I did not emphasize that is extremely important, and I always do it. In order to get the property tax kit, it's almost $30. Obviously, I should have mentioned that there is a cost associated with this kit. For most people, they don't have to do that, but that option does exist.
Okay. And we also got a couple of responses. We had talked to a woman named Candace who bought savings bonds for her child's education, put it in both her name and her children's, and we had some advice on transferring that bond. And tell us briefly what your advice was, and then we'll expand on that.
All right. My advice was that you needed to make an electronic transfer. So in other words, you would make a transfer from paper to electronic, and then you could change the name without triggering any tax consequences. And take it from there, Tess.
Okay. And we actually heard from someone who works at the Federal Reserve, and they said that you actually don't have to do electronic.
That's correct.
All right. Well, let's go to the questions. Our first caller of the day is Shelby, and she is in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hi, Shelby.
Hi, Tess.
And Chris is with me as well, if you'd like to say hello.
Hi, Chris.
Hi.
So what's your question for us today?
Okay, my husband and I are purchasing an online business. It's a ergonomic office product website. It's been on the internet since 96.
So this is a website that's currently owned by someone else?
Yes.
Okay.
So my question is, we're looking into different ways to finance it. It's a cash purchase. Possibilities include getting a home equity line of credit, refinancing our house and getting some cash out, selling some stock, or borrowing against some investments.
All right. Well, Chris, let's go through these options for them. First of all, selling stock.
Well, the big advantage to selling stock, of course, then you'll pay capital gains taxes, but you'll have equity, you'll have a chunk of money. What concerns me about some of the other options, what if it does fail? Then you put your house at risk, your personal finances at risk.
Mm-hmm.
That's if they were to take out a home equity line of credit?
Exactly. To own a small business is a risky endeavor as it is. My main piece of advice would be, first, work with or hire a lawyer that is used to working with small businesses that will work with you in terms of isolating the risk of this business from your personal assets as much as possible, so that if it does go under, a lifetime of work doesn't go poof at the same time.
Okay.
Shelby, can I ask you a quick question? The money that you have in stocks right now, is that separate from your retirement funds?
No, it's not.
So this is your retirement that you're talking about potentially cashing out?
Some of it, yes.
Chris, does that change the calculation at all? I mean, if they're looking at taking out money from what is going to fund their retirement, what do you think?
Two quick thoughts. I mean, one, sometimes people do this. It's a really bad idea if you're taking the money out of a retirement account, because then you pay ordinary income taxes, plus you have to pay the 10% penalty. In this case, it's in a taxable account. It's set aside for retirement, so you don't have a 10% penalty. But, I mean, you really got to raise some questions about the risks. If this succeeds, they're going to have a very good retirement. If it doesn't succeed, money's going to be very tight.
Chris, as a general rule, we tend to tell people not to touch their retirement funds.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay, Shelby, does that help you out?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks for the call.
All right, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, if you've got some questions, hopefully we've got some answers for you. Visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right. Andy from Washington, D.C. has our next question, and he recently vacationed in Salvador, Brazil.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Yeah, I am too. He fell so much in love that he's considering buying a home there. However, he can't afford to pay for it in cash, so he wants to get a home loan. So the question here is, does he borrow in U.S. dollars from an American lender, or does he try to look for an American bank that's involved in the international home loan market? I guess my question would be, are there American banks that are involved in loaning for homes in other countries?
It's pretty small. I think your skepticism is valid. Look, I have a couple of quick reactions. You know, Tess, we've gotten variations on this question. So my first and initial reaction is go back to Salvador, Brazil, and then go back again. Put the financing aside for the moment.
Make sure you absolutely love it.
Absolutely, because all of us have had that experience. But there's a lot to learn about the Brazilian market. And the home mortgage market in Brazil is not the same as it is here in the U.S. by and large. And there are some of the, you know, major multinational banks have a small but growing lending presence. But here's the real trick. It tends to be for their wealthier clients who have a lot of collateral and a lot of assets. The banks that I would approach and that he could approach would be a Citigroup, HSBC. There are also some Latin American banks that have a large presence here in the U.S., and that's another route that you could take.
All right. Well, once again, the phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Do give us a call with your questions. And we are answering those questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Lovers of serious art films, beware. Summer movie season has arrived in the form of a guy in a metal suit. The movie version of the comic book Iron Man opened this week. It's got the requisite big budget visual effects. But all that flash wouldn't seem so spectacular without a little something for your ears. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we tune into a sound effects guy. He's helped movies like the ice hockey flick Miracle score with audiences.
My name is Rob Noakes. I'm 38 years old. I'm a sound effects recordist for feature films and the owner of the sound effects website, sounddogs.com. My personal break as a sound effects field recordist probably was Miracle, just because, you know, I had put so much, you know, I put 8 weeks of effort and $25,000 of my own money to record and build that library for the movie. All these different types of ice sounds with different skaters doing different things. I don't know of any other jobs like this where you wake up in the morning and wonder what you're going to record or where you're going to go to record it. There's no real rules, no rhyme or reason. The whole thing is just getting a good sound that works in a movie. It helps tell the visual story. On the movie Stealth, I was at Miramar Air Base recording F-18s taking off. And an F-18 blasted probably about 50 meters away from where I was. It felt like a phantom ran up my spine and was crushing my neck and my skull. It was so powerful. I was running away from the tarmac. As that happened, I heard an old funny story where a guy was recording a DC-9 and it stalled in flight, and then they crash landed, and he was, you know, yelling and swearing over it, and he ruined the recording. And later he told me, you know, I wish I didn't say anything because it was such a good recording. So, you know, I try to not get involved in the moment and just capture it, because there's not really much you can do. On Isla Lobos in Uruguay with 250,000 sea lions, I noticed that there's a lot of communication and a lot of, like, territorial calls. And as I got closer, their calls changed and they're echoing and calling at me. And then one of them started chasing me. And it's really funny to hear the recording because you hear my gear just flopping and banging and I'm, like, running as fast as I can. They're big, mean creatures. I have two companies of my own. I work for several studios over the course of a year, so I have many sources of income. It's between $200,000 and $350,000 a year. I love collecting sounds. I love recording sounds. I don't really know what to do with myself if I'm not working. I love what I do, and I can't imagine doing anything else.
Learn more about Rob Noakes at marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was produced by Michael Rayfield. There are lots of gizmos that supposedly boost your gas mileage. Do they work? We'll find out. And our own Rico Galliano looks back on years of explaining the basics of finance.
The idea was that I would make this not-so-fun topic fun. The problem was that I didn't know anything about any of it.
The final installment of Educating Rico is next. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Rico Galliano came to work with this show back in 2004. And over the past 4 years, he's graced us with a monthly series called Educating Rico, wherein he learns the basics of personal finance. We've listened to his triumphs and failures, paying special attention to the failures. But 4 years is the length of a college education. And so it seems fitting that we are drawing the series to a close this week. And Rico's here to look back on his journey from moron to Ivy League graduate of the Marketplace Money School of Basic Finance. Hi, Rico.
Nice to see you, Tess.
You never really were a moron, were you?
Yeah. They went out on the street and they found a guy who was drooling. And that was me. No, we decided to do this because it's not the most exciting topic, you know, this sort of basic bare bones finance.
How do you say that?
The basic bare bones stuff. It gets real exciting when you talk about hedge funds.
Right, okay.
Lives are at stake. Not so much, you know, what is a mortgage? And the idea was that I would make this not so fun topic fun. The problem was that I didn't know anything about any of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Orwellian fashion, we decided to turn my ignorance into a strength. But I think what is actually really interesting is how many people immediately understood what we were trying to do and totally sympathized. People who, like me, were actually older folks who really should have known more about personal finance and didn't quite get it. I actually have a clip here I think illustrates why we do this. I was doing a piece about Roth IRAs, and I decided to talk to a listener named Heather Ansorge, who had written to us.
Since I now have saved just enough for retirement, everywhere I looked and everything I heard, they told me to put it in a Roth IRA. And everything I heard was very simple. And I went online, I tried to open up a Roth IRA, and the problem became much, much more complicated than that.
It's not what you think it is, right? I thought that it was just going to be kind of like a glorified savings account.
Yeah, I kind of pictured it like a CD. It had like a fixed interest rate or something like that, and it just grew.
No, but it's like there's 10,000 different things that you can do with a Roth IRA. This is the thing, you know, like anytime you hear somebody say that something in personal finance is simple, I always think, you know, making rice is simple.
I made rice last night and it got burnt.
Oh,
you know what I'm saying?
Poor Heather.
Poor Heather, but poor many of us. That I mean, she's a bioengineering grad student. You know, that this is not a dummy. And we go through our lives, and some of us just can't pay as much attention to this as we should. And it's becoming more and more important.
So, Rico, do you know what a Roth IRA is?
I do.
Well, you seem a little smarter for this experience. Do you feel like you're better off financially just in toto?
Generally speaking, yes, and especially in certain areas. The third one that I did was about student loans.
Mm.
This was back in 2004-5 when interest rates were incredibly low. And I did this piece, and I was told by Janet Bodner of Kiplinger's Personal Finance to consolidate loans right away.
It's 3.4% at the moment. That's a really good rate.
What if I, say, have a credit card that has a lower interest rate than my issuer offers? They're out there, a 3.9% credit card or something.
Now, Rico, do you have a credit card with a 3.99% rate?
Well, no, but... Okay, so you got it?
Okay.
So I took Janet's advice, consolidated, didn't put it on that mythical low-rate credit card, and I've got like a 3% rate on my federal student loans right
nice.
Now, which is the closest I as a non-homeowner can come to bragging about an incredibly great rate on something.
Well, I have to say, you have broadcast many of your stupider financial moves over the years.
yeah. At some point, I realized that that wasn't doing me any favors as far as being a trusted voice of authority in other reporting. So you'll actually notice as the series went on, I started focusing on other people's mistakes as well. My friends and my family. Let's just share the burden of responsibility.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I think we got a lot of listener response to the episode in which I bought a used car.
Uh-huh.
Partially because I reenacted the car buying process with a young girl portraying me, but also I made a really bad mistake that I only realized after I brought the car home. Let's listen to this.
There is frost on my rear window. I, Rico, will simply turn on the rear defroster. There is no rear defroster button!
Yeah, there is no defrost button. There's literally a hole in the dashboard where it should be. You're laughing at me. I deserve it.
Yes, you did, Rico.
Yes, I did. That was Alex Rostin of Edmunds.com, by the way, that I got to embarrass myself in front of, as well as the entire nation.
And so now when you go looking at cars, you make sure that there is a rear defrost button.
Among many other things, that is something you should check for.
Okay. And if you want to hear what else you should check for, we've got all of Rico's pieces on our website. All right, Rico. Favorite moment as you graduate?
Yes, using my father,
oh.
who has a great sense of humor and an awesome radio voice, by the way. But he grew up under FDR when things were taken care of for you, and now everyone's on their own, and you can save $1 million for retirement and still be worried about being able to pay for health care. And I think my dad really sort of got across what that feels like.
Anything catastrophic, and I certainly know people to whom this has happened, I could be wiped out.
You really think you could be wiped out?
Yes.
All right, on a happier note, If I was able to tell you you'll be able to afford it, what would be the thing you would most like to do in your retirement?
Gee, I don't really have any crazy things I'd want to do.
See, this is the difference between you and me. I'd take $100,000 and put it on red or black on roulette in Vegas.
Oh, no. But that's because you were not a product of the Depression, Rico. You came about in plush times.
You've spoiled us, old man. He's got a sense of humor about it, you know, and I think that's hopefully something that people got out of the series, is that personal finance is difficult. Yes, sometimes the challenges are immense, but we can laugh at it and we can learn from it.
And have you learned from it?
Absolutely. It's been great.
Thanks so much, Rico. Thanks for getting us all educated.
Thanks, Tess.
Speaking of education, this week Congress approved legislation to help college students who are having trouble getting loans. The Education Department can now buy up federally backed student loans from banks, and it can provide money to state agencies that will then lend it to both students and the colleges themselves.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
We're back again with Getting Personal. I'm Tess Vigeland. With me is our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. And Chris, let's reach into the email bag once again. Rick writes in from Omaha, Nebraska, and a few years ago, his company downsized and he was let go, a story that we're hearing more and more these days with the economy the way it is.
Yeah.
He says that his company did what a lot of others have done. They got rid of all their older and experienced workers first to bring in all the youngins who will work for nothing. But now he's running his own home remodeling business. He says he loves it, but he's wondering about his Social Security, and here's why. He hasn't paid into it for years. And Chris, he's wondering if that will have an effect on the payments he'll receive. I'm going to make a wild guess and say, yeah.
The self-employment tax rate on net earnings is 15.3%. So I'm a lot less concerned right now about what you're going to be able to draw upon when you retire. What I'm really concerned about is you're not paying your Social Security taxes. And the self-employed do pay Social Security taxes.
So in other words, the tax man is not going to be happy about this.
He's not going to be happy. So get yourself to an accountant, work with somebody or an enrolled agent, someone who's used to working with the IRS. We're going to have to do some amended returns. So get yourself professional help and let's deal with this situation and then put it behind us. And by the way, then you will be credited for those years you've been working when you do eventually retire and draw on your Social Security check.
So you cannot get away with not paying your Social Security taxes.
No, the government does not like that. You know, it's the cost of doing business as a self-employed.
So if he's been filing his taxes on a regular basis, how did the IRS not catch this?
I have no idea, although I did. I've done some looking on the internet on some previous times, and there have been a number of court cases surrounding this kind of an issue. So I'm not sure how that falls through the cracks, but it's something that you really don't want to fall through the cracks.
All right. So, Rick, you're going to need to pay those back Social Security taxes. And once you do, the IRS will be happy and Social Security will pay out to you what you deserve when you retire. Thanks for writing in. Our website is marketplace.org, and to send us a question, you can get on the Getting Personal link there, or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, let's go to the phones. Megan is with us from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
What do you do there in Minnesota?
I go to school right now for art and design.
Oh, terrific. So what are you planning to do with your degree?
Well, not quite sure yet. But next year, I'm hoping to study abroad in Denmark.
And what would you be studying?
Architecture and just general European design.
Sounds lovely. All right, so what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I was wondering if the market right now, the economy, has any adverse effects on student loans. And also, with the studying abroad, if there's any options for financing that besides student loans.
That wouldn't be with your school? It would be a separate study opportunity?
Right, separate from the school.
Okay. First of all, the answer is yes. The economy is making it tough for some folks to get student loans. The credit crunch, of course, affecting that. Chris, what are her options?
Well, there are a couple of options. One I'm usually reluctant to recommend, but is a private student loan. And the reason why I'm reluctant with private student loans is you don't have a lot of the benefits that you do with student loans that are underwritten by the federal government. And for example, once you graduate, boy, you got to start paying them fast. There's no such thing as forbearance and a number of protections that if you are having a hard time getting a job or a hard time making an income, that the regular student loans give you. There's always the option of there's a very large architecture community in the Twin Cities, and whether there might be some work that you could do while you're over in Denmark for one of the architecture firms. Maybe there's some little bit of research, give you a little bit of a stipend, might not pay for the whole trip over there, but perhaps there's a deal that you could strike with one of the architectural firms.
That sounds really good, actually. Thanks.
I don't know whether you can, but it's worth a try. And at the university, you're at the School of Art and Design. I would imagine that they might be able to strike some contacts for you.
Yeah.
So when are you thinking you might go?
This coming fall.
Well, good luck.
All right. Thank you very much.
Take care. All right. Well, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Used to be you'd get a job at a company, work there for 40, 50 years, and retire. You'd have a nice pension, and you could spend the rest of your days relaxing and playing golf. No more. These days, seniors are looking to stay in the workforce. Some of them just want to keep active. Some didn't squirrel enough money away to retire. But here's one potential drawback to working through your golden years. If you're not careful, you can actually lose out on some money. Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
Back in 1967, the Beatles imagined retirement like this.
You can knit a sweater by the fireside. Sunday mornings, go for a ride.
But Monday mornings could have a lot of retirees going for a ride to work. More than half of boomers say they haven't saved enough. Many are considering working past retirement age. Stuart Ritter is a financial planner with T. Rowe Price.
If folks are reaching the age where they're thinking about retirement and don't feel like they have enough money, working extra years is one of the most powerful ways to make up for that.
Working into your golden years can pose some problems. Chantel Sheeks is a benefits attorney with Buck Consultants. She says it can be especially complicated for seniors who want to work part-time.
The implications of going part-time are going to impact whether or not you may get a contribution to your 401k plan. It may impact whether or not you're eligible for the health care coverage from your employer.
And a company's pension benefits are often based on your salary when you retire. So if you take a pay cut to work fewer hours, you risk your pension being permanently lowered. Social Security payments can also be docked if you earn a certain amount of money. The Senate Committee on Aging is working to change some of these policies. It introduced a bill this week that would give tax credits to businesses that create flexible work plans for seniors. It's also pushing for health care and pension protections. Senator Herb Kohl chairs the committee.
By doing these things, we will take care of our economic needs in the decades ahead and address the needs of seniors to stay in the workforce beyond age 65.
Cole points out that over the next couple of decades, around 20% of our population will be over 65. That's a lot of experience leaving the workforce. For now, people nearing retirement should check with employers to see what effect continuing to work will have on their benefits, says T. Rowe Price's Stuart Ritter. But he says the penalties that are in place shouldn't discourage people.
It's like someone saying, well, I'm tired of paying all these income taxes, so what I'm going to do is tell my boss to give me a cut in pay.
Ritter says an extra year of work has a double benefit. It's an extra year of contributions to a 401k and an extra year of letting savings appreciate. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
So the Kaiser Family Foundation surveyed 2,000 Americans about their economic worries. Guess what tops the list? Yep, gas prices. Presidential candidates John McCain and Hillary Clinton backed the idea of a summer holiday for federal gas taxes. Barack Obama and many economists say that'll only save about $30 total per driver. And then there are all those internet and TV ads promising that this or that doohickey will help rev up your fuel economy.
There's an incredible surge in popularity anytime gas prices go up, and we see the invention, in quotation marks, of new devices that are guaranteed to boost your fuel economy.
That's Philip Reed, senior consumer advice editor at Edmunds.com. He says most of these things are just fuelishness. One group of products involves stuff you're supposed to pour into the tank.
It's usually some sort of fluid in a mysterious-looking vial, and it's supposed to unlock some sort of molecular structure inside your gasoline.
Fuelishness. Another category is attachments around your gas tank, like magical magnets that supposedly alter the chemical makeup of the gas before it goes into the combustion chamber.
Another is there's quite a few that have to do with swirling the air as it goes into the intake manifold. And then there are pills, solid pills that you put in your gas tank. So there's quite a few of them.
Utter fuelishness. Experts have tested all these products and found that some of them made the gas mileage worse. Such fuelishness. So what can you do to get more out of your tank?
If you go from being an aggressive driver, which almost everybody is these days, to being what we call a smooth and relaxed driver, you can see at least a 30% increase in your fuel economy right away. And that's without changing anything on your car, only changing what you do with your right foot.
There you have it, people. When it comes to saving on gas money, just chill. That means you, Boston. I joke, I kid. I love Beantown. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, our look at the global food crisis, a special series across all Marketplace programs.
If by investing in commodities, it results in a shortage of affordable food for people in developing countries, that would be a big concern for me.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Rico Galliano, Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 company helping members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.